You are listening to Punk News Podcast 506. Back in the swing of things. Bing. Punk News Podcast is features editor John Gentile. I'm here with managing editor, not managing editor Adam White, contributing editor Adam White, and news editor and more Ben Crosby, great, yes. Singer or total dickbag or both. Fair enough. Adam White, Ben Crosby, great singer, total dickbag or both?
I'll go with both. Sure, everyone's a bit of both.
And more Ben Crosby, some of the all time greatest, most heartwarming Christmas songs. But what can we do when the singer of the most heartwarming Christmas songs, you know, chestnuts roasting on an open fire, pretty paper. What do we do when this man who brings us so much warmth and familial joy was a real creep to his own family? What do we do with that?
Oh, that's hard. I think it's like, wasn't it Joan Crawford? She was really horrible to her kids. Wasn't that her? And then people are still, yeah, like, she's a great actress. And they kind of divorced her from, like, how she was at home with how she was on screen.
Adam, what do you do when you're, you know, out at Tim Hortons? It's Christmas Eve morning. You're looking forward to celebrating Christmas Eve with the kids and the family and the big meal the next day. And you're sitting there drinking a Tim Hortons brand coffee. And you hear chestnuts roasting on an open fire. What do you do when you hear this velvety croon? But as we know, even though this man is arguing for family togetherness, was very mean to his own family. What do you do, Adam?
I mean, Tim's has done worse shit than Bing in the past couple of years. So, I mean, if anything, that would lessen the impact. Where are you going with this strange intro, John? I'm going to interrupt it right now and open this beer because I didn't have a good spot to do that. So here we go. Foley effects time. There we go. So,
Oh, go ahead, Adam.
No, there's foam all over my computer and desk now. This is not what I intended.
Well, this is the Punk News Podcast. You can always use that podcast at punknews.org. We're going to hit the mail. First mail is right here. And this is from Patty Ford, but I don't think it's Patty from Dillinger Ford. Maybe it is. I'm freaking out. I am losing my mind. I used to go to shows every week, sometimes twice a week, big, medium, and small. At this point, I'd go see Smash Mouth. What can I do to hold myself over until live shows return? Will they return? Existential scream from Patty Ford.
They'll return. I'm so done with this. Like, I'm a full believer of all of the you know, all the pandemic science and all that stuff. You know, I'll follow whatever safety regulation they want me to do. I'll stand on my head and, you know, put a garbage bag over my feet if that's what it'll take to get through this. But I don't buy any of this. Like, the new normal is that, you know, we're all going to live in spaceman suits for the rest of our lives. Horseshit. I'm not down with that. So Patty, if you're not the Dillinger Four Patty, that's good because, If you are, I may have seen your penis, but otherwise, I think there's going to be shows again. I don't know what you do to get between, like, to get through to when shows happen. I was thinking about this myself. I was thinking, like, the first show that I go to after this, I'm going to mosh. Like, I haven't moshed since I was a child, but I'm in the pit. I don't care. I want to just, like, bang into people and get covered in sweat and break my glasses. That's my plan. So fantasizing about that is really getting me through. I don't know, man. I really hope I don't come out of this and then go to the first show and then immediately fall into old habits of, like, being too old and tired and lazy to go to shows. because then I will have truly wasted this learning experience.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I mean, this is not a COVID story, but about 3 years ago, I went and saw it. I mean, it wasn't a basement show, but it was essentially a basement show out in Lancaster. I don't know why I'm being weird about it. It was Posers, Shitty Friends, Trash Knife before I knew Trash Knife. And that's it. And maybe one other band. And I moshed, I moshed the entire night for the first time in like 3 or 4 years, like straight moshing. And like the floor was like slick with sweat. So it was like ice skating. Adam, it was so much fun. Like it was, and also I was a little bit older than most people there. And a lot of people were kind of like wimpy moshing. And I wasn't dickbag moshing, but I was old school moshing. And it was freaking awesome, Adam. It was awesome.
I feel like so much of my lack of mosh comes down to like the most solvable problems. Like I'm like, oh, I have this beer and I don't want to break my glasses and all my keys are in my pocket. Like all these are problems that could be solved that I have just leaned on as I've become an old person about why I'm not dancing. And there needs to be more dancing. But yeah, I don't know. I keep seeing people putting on these strange shows, and I'm so far not particularly tempted to partake in any of them. You know, these drive-in shows and things like that. Like, I feel like I just want to grip my teeth and get through to when we can have actual shows again, and not attend some sort of strange. You know, like everybody gets inside their own, refrigerator and watch a band play a kilometer away kind of thing. Like, I don't know if I want to do that. Like, Em, have you been tempted? Have you gone? Have you thought about going to any of these like strange pandemic shows?
It's crossed my mind, but I haven't, because I don't want to pay for that. And I don't want to like sound rude or whatever, but I can like find a live album, or I can find like recordings on YouTube or something. You know, I want to be like fully a part of it. Like 100% like miss the pit, and that's where I'm going to go, and it's safe 100% of the time.
But yeah, I agree with the letter writer though, man. Like it's becoming like it's becoming surreal. It's becoming, you know, it's going to feel like a long ass winter. That's what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, make it even worse. You know, this band I haven't shut up about recently, this band Suck out of Germany, which kicks ass. They're playing live shows in Germany and like Switzerland this weekend or next weekend. It's like, oh, Europe's already got it sorted out, and we're still not that much better than we were 4 months ago. Ugh. Anyways, here's another letter. This is from Nathaniel, who's written the Lone Punker. Hi, podcast. Congratulations on over 500 episodes. I've been listening every week since 2016 and really enjoy your show. John, I'm listening to Scum Dogs of the Universe for the first time, and something caught my ear. I wonder if you happen to know what the melody performed on the bagpipes in the intro to The Horror of Yig. Using Google is cheating. I'll put the answer below. And honestly, like, so Horror of Yig is one of Guar's medium-known songs. It's on their classic album, Scum Dogs of the Universe. And it opens up with a bagpipe, and then it Kurtz, what Heart of Darkness. What's that movie? Colonel Kurtz, Heart of Darkness.
Apocalypse Now,
yeah. It has a clip from that, and then the song is about Guar flying through the universe and meeting a Lovecraftian horror. And so there's a bagpipe intro, and Nathaniel is asking me what is that melody, and the answer is I don't know. I always just thought it was Dave Brocky blowing on the bagpipes because in tribute to Bon Scott of AC/DC, which he's a huge fan, but I was wrong. Nathaniel says, answer. It's the theme from the second movement of Antonin Dvorak's Ninth Symphony, the New World Symphony. The melody was later adapted with lyrics for vocal performance. The song was called Going Home, and now the melody is commonly referred to as the Going Home theme. I wonder why Guar selected that theme for the intro to this song. Do you have any thoughts? And that's Cheers from the Lone Punker. And he says, since you asked about it on the show, please upgrade y'all's recording equipment. And Lone Punker, we definitely are working on that, and by we I mean me. With regards to why did Guar select that, you know, I don't know. I know that the track Horror of Yig is, and I didn't even know this till recently. It's the version you hear on the album is actually a remix, and the original version has never been released. The remix was done by Uncle Ministry, Al Jorgensen of Ministry. So a lot of the material on that is Al Jorgensen. So I don't know if that's one of, and if you listen to that track in comparison to the other tracks on the album, it does have somewhat different style to it. And so I don't know if that was a Guar edition or an Uncle Al edition, but I will say it further underscores that Guar is an extremely clever band. And while they are bloody and funny and gross and obscene, there is a deep intelligence behind that. And that's all I can. I don't really know why they chose that, except for maybe it was funny and weird.
Don't look for us to chime in on your deep Guar deep dive, letter writer.
You can always reach a podcast at punknews.org. I went to Record Store Day, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, and I'll just be very brief about this, and then we'll play a song. I went to Record Store Day at my local record store, Electric Avenue Records, and what they did is, because it's COVID and all that stuff, is instead of you waiting in line the day before at noon, you emailed them what you wanted, and then I don't know if it was random or if it was based on a time, and they said, come in tomorrow at 11:30, and we'll bring your crap to your car. And so that's what I did, and it worked out just fine. A lot of people were like, well, that's not record shopping. It's like, well, yeah, it's COVID, bro. You know what I mean? Like just deal with, like if your biggest problem, you don't get to stand in line at 4 a.m. until 9 a.m. to buy records, and you get it delivered to your car at 10:30 that one day of the year, then that's not that big of a tragedy, you know what I'm saying? And so I thought, I don't know how a lot of other stores did it, but I thought that was a pretty good solution for Record Store Day in 2020. It's the first of four Record Store Days we're having over the next 4 weeks. Next 4 months. A lot of cool stuff came out for Record Store Day. David Bowie live album, The Soul Tour, which is awesome. Rob Halford's Fight put out their second album, which is cool to have on vinyl. The only other release is extremely limited release in Brazil. I'm trying to think Iggy Pop put out a box set called Kiss My Blood. And it honestly didn't need to be a box set. They could have done it on two records, but they did it on three records. They made it a box set just to make it more expensive. And there's a lot of crappy Iggy Pop live albums just because the sound quality is terrible. This one is excellent. It's Iggy Pop in 91. He's at the top of his game, but it's close. Great set list. And also the other cool thing that came out was the Pogues live at the BBC, which has some Rum Sodomy in the last tracks live. And it is an excellent release. And would you do the Record Store Day thing or not really?
I think it's a cool idea with ordering your records ahead of time. You know, I think that's really good. The releases are really interesting. I don't have any way of playing records right now. So
And more, do you have a record player?
Yes. So I'm working on it. Someday, one of these days.
Fair enough. Let's play a song. I've got a song you can play, or someone else is champing at the bit. You can play a song. I don't care.
You can go. I got one that I'll throw in later. No problem. But before we go off of this here, I just want to. I didn't go to Record Store Day because I'm scared of the world right now. And I don't go outside. But on the subject of records, and this is maybe a little hint for M to about which company she may want to transact with when she gets into the game here. So I'm a big proponent of a company out of Boston called U-Turn Audio. They make turntables. It was one of these companies that was like originally like a Kickstarter way back in the day. But it's a bunch of like MIT or I don't know. What's is MIT Boston? I don't know. Who's in Boston? One of those.
Yeah, Massachusetts Technology.
That's what the M stands for, right? Yeah. A bunch of engineers from there started this like super minimalist turntable company a number of years ago. So, and their tables are like intentionally minimal, all exposed. Like the belt is completely exposed, wraps around the platter. You move it between 33 and 45 with your finger by like knocking it up and down a knob that it's on. No moving parts that it doesn't need, no bells and whistles or anything like that, but like really high quality, sounds really good and really affordable because of that, you know, and also made in the USA and all that, you know, USA.
Oh yeah.
So
that's what I'm talking about.
So I bought one of these suckers back in 2014, I think. And it's been my daily driver. I love it. If it broke, I would buy another one sight unseen. And so the other day I was playing something. What was I playing? I was playing Pup's Morbid Stuff. And I'm like, I'm like, something sounds off. Like, it sounds like it is like half a step too slow. And I don't know why that is. So it's basically all stock from when I bought it. So I emailed the company and I said, hey, is this sounding kind of off because the belt, it's just like a rubber cord, right? Like, is the belt kind of warped at this point and it needs to be replaced? Because if so, like, I'll order one. It's only like $5 or something to order a belt. But I just want to make sure that that is the case before I order it, because, you know, things take a while to get over the border, especially right now with, you know, the fact that your post office is being attacked by evil forces. So
true that.
So I email them and I'm like, just checking if what I am dealing with sounds like it is the belt. And what do you expect when you email a company something like that? That, you know, maybe a day later or so, some lower level person is gonna email you back and give you some sort of answer, right? And I was expecting like the normal level of service. I certainly did not play any kind of, hey, this is Adam from the wildly popular Punk News podcast, you know, complaining about a thing. Service me, right? None of that. But I get an email back within like 4 minutes of me emailing them from the co-founder of the company. And he's like, oh, so, you know, sorry to hear you're having difficulties. It actually sounds like you have a tight spindle rather than the belt. So we're going to send you, one of those.
Spindle,
yeah, I guess. Right. It's a condition for men my age. Right. But he's like, we'll send you one ASAP for free, and we'll throw in a belt as well, just in case it is the belt, but we don't think it is. It's probably the spindle. You can change the spindle really easily with like a Phillips screwdriver. Here we go. Give me your address. And like literally within like 8 minutes of me reaching out to them, like the part was in the mail to come here for it. And I was trying to like think back, and I'm like, am I somehow on their radar? Like, do they have some sort of like crack social media team that knows that I like Instagram a lot of records that I'm listening to, and their product gets into the feed, and therefore they're like, oh, we got to keep this guy happy because he gives us a lot of free advertising or something like that. Like, is there some angle to this going on? But I can't think that there is. And I don't even think, like, I didn't transact with them with like my punknews.org address or anything that someone would have recognized. So as far as I can tell, they're just great. So you know, maybe this is what they're hoping for by giving good service, is that people talk about it on podcasts or whatever. But fucking U-Turn Audio out of Boston, just, you know, batting 1,000 here. So, you know, go get one of theirs.
Yeah, I will say, remember when companies weren't gigantic monopolies, so they actually had to provide good customer service, and you were happy to give them money because they were local companies that gave good customer service. Remember those glory days? Listen, people, buy American and screw Amazon. That's what I'm saying.
There you go. Okay, so John, play song.
Actually, you know, this will be a short. I wanted to talk about Taylor Swift, and I had this big speech, but I, you know, I'm kind of over it now. But check this out. Taylor Swift is cool. I mean, Taylor Swift's music, it's fine. It's perfectly acceptable pop music. It's fine. However, Taylor Swift signed a bunch of CDs and mailed them to independent record stores to get people to go to independent record stores. That's rad as hell. You know what I mean? Like, while certain punk bands are signing like exclusive deals with Best Buy or Target or even Walmart, Taylor Swift, of all people, is getting people to go into independent record stores by signing a whole bunch of CDs and mailing them out at normal price. So kudos to Taylor Swift, man. Taylor Swift is punk. That's what I'm saying.
If you play a Taylor Swift punk, song, but we are going to get sued.
I'm not going to play Taylor Swift. What I am playing is a Guar song. Guar. I don't know if this is why the Lone Punker was talking about Scum Dogs, or maybe he was talking about Scum Dogs because I talk about Guar literally every episode, so I'll try to pull that back. But Guar recently re-released their seminal Scum Dogs of the Universe album. It is heavily remixed, and actually some of the recorded the tracks, the music tracks, are actually a little different. I'm not sure that it's better than the old version. It sounds a lot different, but it's certainly interesting. And I'm going to play The Horror of Yig just because it's a rad track, and it's one of the rare Guar songs that has Guar singing about flying through the universe as opposed to being trapped on Earth. So this is from the new version of Scum Dogs on the Universe, of Scum Dogs of the Universe by Guar, The Horror of Yig.
Horror of the faith. And you must make a friend of horror. Horror and moral terror are your friends. they are not, then they are enemies.
And that was the Harv Yig by Gwar. Let's drop into some heavy topics this week. Big shakeups at Maximum Rock and Roll this week. Of course, as you probably know, well, actually, I'm sure as you know, Maximum Rock and Roll is not the first punk zine, but certainly one of the biggest and inarguably one of the most important punk zines, starting in like 82, I think, or 83, or maybe it's 86, I forget. I think it was like 82 or 83. The Dead Kennedys were still around. So it's got to be like 83 or something. And so last year they stopped their print run and they were digital only. Earlier this week, they announced I would say, significantly radical change to how the magazine is going to operate. Going forward, Maximum Rock and Roll will not publish any material submitted by white writers unless it's an interview with people of color. Further, they will begin to pay black writers, and they've never paid writers before. They did not say if they would pay non-black minority writers or underrepresented people, and they did not say what – I'm not trying to be weird, but what constitutes a black person. They didn't say what they would do with mixed biracial people or mixed race people. And so I was not that surprised that on Punk News – on the Punk News website, the commenters pretty much gave this nothing but saying it's banned, dismissal. However, I would say pretty significantly to my surprise, on the Maximum Rock and Roll Instagram, on the Punk News Facebook, and the Punk News Twitter, reactions were split about 50-50. Half people saying this is a dumb, stupid, and racist thing, and the other half people saying this is a great idea. I've got a lot of feelings on this, so I don't know if you guys want me to kick it off or if you guys want to kick it off and let me respond.
I have. This is one of these stories that I had so many, like, competing thoughts that I made fucking notes. Like, this is my notes paper, and I'm looking at it now, and it's just a bunch of scribbling, so I can't actually read it, so I may as well just get rid of it. But yeah, so, John... How do we focus this conversation? How do we approach this? Do you want to lead it? Do you want me to shoot? I mean, should we toss it to M and then destroy M's opinion after she innocently voices it? Like, I don't know the right way to go about this, because it is the kind of thing that you could that you can take three or four angles on, and I only say that because I have three or four angles on this written in front of me right now.
Well, I've got one angle. Here's my one angle. This is stupid and racist. It's unquestionably racist because they are literally saying one race gets benefits that another race doesn't, that all other races don't get, and you get it just by being that race. That is the definition of racist, specifically treating people differently based on the racial backgrounds. This is racist, and it's stupid. Further, if the goal is to increase the voice or amplify the voice of people of color in the punk community, well, then the answer to the way to do that is not by being racist. The way to doing that is by amplifying voices of people of color, getting writers that are people of color, covering those kinds of shows. And it's not as and that's how you do it. You don't do it by saying white people are bad or white people are less deserving of a voice than non-white people. It's stupid. The only thing that does is generate resentment and hatred, and is literally segregation. And I'm pretty sure that for the past, well, I'm pretty sure since Martin Luther King and before, segregation is a really bad thing. And now Maximum Rock and Roll astoundingly is saying, no, segregation is a great thing, and we need to segregate in order to equal, separate but equal. That's what they're doing. Maximum Rock and Roll is arguing separate but equal, which it reminds me of the whole straight edge movement, where the whole idea of Ian MacKaye and Montreux with straight edge was think for yourself, don't do what the crowd is doing. And somehow that led all the way to Krishna Corps, whereas people, and also what's that other band? The band with the guy that's like very right-wing Islam. What's the name of that band? I forget the name of the band. Where if you ask them a question, the only thing they can respond with is religious scripture. And so so far around the globe, it's the perverse opposite of what it's supposed to be. And so it's sick. Further, not only is it sick in that respect, it's sick in the respect that it's saying black people I don't ever agree with the concept that every single black person has had it worse than every single white person, that, or every non-black person, and therefore black people should get paid and non-black people shouldn't. I don't certainly the amount of arrests against black people and police violence against black people is higher. But it doesn't mean every single black person has it worse than every single non-black person. I mean, that's racism. But what I'm getting at is I think it's quite sick and perverse. They're saying, well, black people have had it bad, which many black people have, but Native Americans, oh, we don't care about them, you know. Or, I mean, the history of Native Americans in North America is obscenely terrible, but they're not paying them. They're not actively promoting Native American writers. How about Jewish people? Or how about gay people? Or how about non-binary people? They're saying, no, the only thing that matters here is black people. And I'm not saying that black issues don't matter. I'm saying black issues do matter a great deal. But to segregate black people and say, well, this is the only issue that we're worried about right now, and any other issue doesn't matter right now, is sick and perverse and really only sows discord and division and is fundamentally racist. And I just don't know what you're thinking here. I mean, I just think it's bizarre. It's stupid. I think it's so bizarre that Maximum Rock and Roll, arguably the most progressive of all punk zines, or, you know, well-known punk zines, is literally arguing not only separate but equal, but separate, and one race gets a bump that the other race doesn't get, and the other race doesn't get, and other races, mind you, don't get a chance to talk, but this one race does get a chance to talk. As I've said, underscore, if you want more black writers, then get more black writers. Don't attack other races and say, well, your voice doesn't matter. It's bizarre and sick and racist. Adam?
Ooh, John. Okay. I don't disagree with you. I may phrase things in a more gentle and Canadian way, but I don't disagree with you there. Because I'm looking at this as, this is a conflict between cause and effect, right? This is a conflict between like their intent and their way of going about it. And so let's put two scenarios out there in the world. So let's say Maximum Rock and Roll did not make this announcement in any particular way. Let's say that the next issue. Now, I don't know if this
I got to interrupt you. One other thing that I do want to add, I meant to say this, is not only is this bizarre, sick, and racist, it's definitely illegal. To pay people based on their race is unquestionably illegal. If you want to have a private publication, hey, we're only going to accept writers from black people, or we're only going to accept white people, or only Italian people, or whatever, as a private publication, you can do that. But you may not hire/contract/employ/pay people based on their race. They're saying they're, quote, collecting donations, but flip the table. If you were saying, oh, we're collecting donations that are only going to white people but not black people, you know, I don't think that would hold up. So this is unquestionably illegal, too. I'm sorry, Adam.
That is an interesting point. I was going to give you shit for interrupting me, but that's actually a really interesting point. Okay, so let's think about two scenarios here. So let's put forth the scenario where Maximum Rock and Roll did not make this announcement. So let's say the next issue. Now, again, issue I'm unsure of, because since they've stopped their print publication, I'm not quite sure what the how Maximum Rock and Roll shows up. Like, is it just a website, like Bungie, that posts stuff, or is it?
They post batches of reviews. They have a podcast, and they do articles here and there, but not that often.
Okay, so let's. I'm going to keep talking about issues, because that's how I recognize Maximum Rock and Roll. So let's say the next issue of Maximum Rock and Roll did a cover story on either or the Toronto punk band, the OBGMs, or the Lingua Franca Festival in Toronto, which is I'm using my Canadian shit here, because that's all I know anymore. But the Lingua Franca Festival is a festival that highlights musicians and bands that play rock and roll music from the black, indigenous, people of color realm. Right. So let's say they did that, and they either focused on the OBGMs, because they have a big record coming out, a lot of hype going into that one. Much of it coming from the band themselves, but also, you know, it sounds like a really cool record. Or they look at Lingua Franca, which is more on the Maximum Rock and Roll scale of things, in that there's definitely no money involved, and it's, you know, a bunch of individuals sort of making something happen on the grassroots. But let's say they gave all of their focus to something like that. Now, does that benefit and create a level of inclusion and exposure for artists of color within the punk rock scene in a better way than what they did. And I would argue yes, because at that point they're saying to their existing audience, without having to qualify it, here is some cool rock and roll that you should pay attention to, and we're telling you why it's important in the story. They didn't do that. What they did was, before the story came out, they've made this grand pronouncement about what they're going to do, knowing full and well that the way in which that they made this announcement was going to be bombastic and controversial and cause a lot of stink. But by doing that, they did just what you said, which is that they have caused resentment, right? Like they've taken whatever their audience was, and they have blunted their audience because they've turned a certain amount of their audience against them. And not because that audience that they've all of a sudden angered is racist per se, although maybe they are, but they've turned audience against them because of all the reasons that you've just mentioned, and that a lot of people are going to look at this not through the standpoint of like, oh great, it's helping people that are underrepresented in the scene. They're going to look at it for all the reasons that you just pointed out, where, you know, this is actually just discriminatory in the other direction and everything else, right? They're going to look at all of those types of arguments. So all of a sudden, Maximum Rock and Roll, in announcing this, has like torpedoed a certain segment of their existing audience, which means whatever is to come after this is now going to be produced for a audience that is quantitatively less than what they had prior to making the announcement. So if we assume that the next thing that they release is going to be a big feature about a black punk band, well, all of a sudden that's going to get less attention than it would have before they made this announcement, because they've ticked off a certain amount of their audience, rather than just going out and doing the work and letting the work speak for itself and presenting the black punk band to the audience that they had. So why? So why do that? Like, why shoot yourself in the foot instead of just going about and doing work? Because if Maximum Rock and Roll just decided internally that, you know what, there is a severe issue of underrepresentation in the scene for, I'm going to use my words. I'm not going to say, you know, BIPOC or anything like that. I'm just going to say for black artists, right? So what if they said there is an underrepresentation in the scene for black artists, right? How are we going to do that? They could go and make sure that, like, you know, they could go and farm out to their writers, you know, go cover these artists. They could make sure that those are the things that they're accepting as proposals. They can make sure those are the things that they're promoting heavily and making their quote unquote cover stories, even though there isn't a cover anymore. Like, they could be doing that and then demonstratively giving the spotlight, taking their brand and promoting those artists using their brand. But they didn't do that. They made it about them. So the story is not that, you know, a major and important black punk band like the OBGMs or like, you know, or like John Crow or Burner or any of those bands out of Toronto right now that I'm talking about, right? It's not that those bands are all of a sudden getting the Maximum Rock and Roll spotlight. The spotlight is on Maximum Rock and Roll because of the controversy that they caused by making this announcement in the way that they did. And we're not talking about the music then. We're not talking about the artists that they're trying to promote. We're talking about whether the thing that Maximum Rock and Roll has done is even legal. So at that point, whatever you were intending to do, even if the outcome that you wanted to produce was good, you've reduced your ability to create that good outcome by doing this in the way that you did. Now, I get the argument from the outer world that, like, well, Adam, this is the way that Maximum Rock and Roll's always operated. They're loud and they're crass, and they don't do things subtly, and they do things with a sledgehammer because, you know, that's super punk rock and that's the way that they operate. And then, sure, I guess, but is it worth reducing the amount of good that you can do because you're trying to keep up with the brand of being like a loud asshole about everything that you do? I don't know if that's worth it. So yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing where I would be I think, frustrating to some of our like super punk listeners and stuff like that. I would be entirely willing to give this kind of thing a more rope than I think John would, because I would be willing to look at it and say, and make all the arguments where I go, okay, well, you know what? It's a private publication. It's not required to do anything. They can make their own editorial decisions. And you know what? Maybe, you know, given the power that they have and the brand that they have, they should use it for good in a way that is, you know, attention getting. But I don't see them having done anything here that's going to actually accomplish the ultimate goal that they're trying to set. I see what they've done is they've gone and they've thrown a grenade into the middle of their readership, and whatever they come out of is not going to be, it's not going to have the impact that they would have had if they would have just done the work without making it about them. And I can't speculate about who at Maximum Rock and Roll is making these decisions, because I don't really understand their organizational structure. I mean, they have a board and they have people that come on with these remote meetings and help them make these decisions. So it's entirely possible that this decision was made by people that were on the board, that were people of color that decided that this was the best way to go about this. But I have a sneaking suspicion that it wasn't, because it doesn't seem to bear the scrutiny of, you know, what can we do that will have the maximum positive impact for our goal here. This does not seem to be that. This seems to be, you know, our audience is dwindling. It has dwindled to the point where we can't, you know, financially keep our publication in print anymore. And here is something attention getting that we can do that puts us on the right side of history. But again, that has nothing to do with benefiting people of color. That has everything to do with benefiting Maximum Rock and Roll, the brand.
You think this puts them on the right side of history?
I think they're trying to position themselves on the right side of history. I think they're doing it in a way that's dumb. And I think that if you were to go convene a board that had, you know, that was made up of musicians that were people of color, that were, you know, from all the walks of underrepresented people that were in punk rock, I really doubt that this statement and the way that they made it and the way that they made this announcement would have been the most strategically apt thing that group of people would have come up with. This has a degree of like nihilism to it that, on the one hand, is very on brand for, you know, being the punk rock publication, because, you know, hey, whatever, we're just gonna do this, fuck you, right? Like, I get that, but I don't think it plays out in a way that's going to have the impact that it could have had. Like, again, Maximum Rock and Roll could have made the decisions that they, you know, that they could have gone and, like, look at it this way. They could have gone and looked at the kind of artists that they've promoted in the past. And they could say, okay, clearly that when you compare who we have promoted to the population of the United States, for example, we are way overrepresentative. We are way overrepresenting white artists compared to the population. Now, that can be fixed, but I think that the thing that they'd have to admit to themselves is that they'd have to look at it and say, okay, that can be fixed, but that's not something we can just fix with a hammer. It's a thing that has to be fixed over time, which is to say, there's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy there, which is that you have less people of color in rock and roll because rock and roll is less a place that has made itself welcoming to people of color, which means that if you want to actually, you know, get that percentage back up, you have to A, be giving some focus to artists of color, but like also be doing that in a way that is going to encourage others to kind of come in and, you know, feel comfortable within that scene. And I actually compare like what Maximum Rock and Roll has done to what of all organizations, when you want to compare the amount of money involved, to what the Oscars just did. And the Oscars look like they're fucking thinking compared to what Maximum Rock and Roll is. Are you aware of what the Oscars just did?
Yeah, I'm extremely against what the Oscars just did.
Right, but look at the methodology by which they did it, right? So the Oscars have said that, you know, they have this end goal, same end goal. We want to increase the diversity of voices that are being represented in what we're awarding, right? So in the same end goal, we want to increase the diversity of what's being written about in our magazine. So Maximum Rock and Roll is
that's not what they're doing, though.
Let me make the point about the methodology here, right? So Maximum Rock and Roll is just like, fuck it, we're gonna create this discriminatory policy about paying people, and we're only gonna, you know, include writing that writes about artists of this color, and, you know, to hell with the rest, right? So they've done all that, which again has pissed a bunch of people off, has excluded probably the majority of the punk rock bands and things like that that they would have otherwise written about from their coverage, and therefore has probably lessened the amount of impact and audience that they're going to have. So they've gone about it that way. The Oscars way of going about it was they're saying, okay, at this point in the future, which is not right now, but is in the reasonable future, we're going to change our criteria for a big award. And we're going to say for our big award, you can't just be, you know, the film that is voted the most for Best Picture. You have to be the film that is voted the most for Best Picture, but you also have to fulfill, like, what was it? Like, two of these three core criteria. And they're like, you know, either the, you know, some of the lead actors have to be from an underrepresented group, or 30% or whatever it is of the actors in minor roles have to be from an underrepresented group, or the movie has to center on, you know, these are that groups, like, or the crew has to be at least a certain percentage of this, right? Where they're not saying we're just going to like nuke everything that we have and only award stuff of this, you know, that fits this criteria. What they're saying is that, you know, you have a number of these boxes that you can tick, and we want to ease the industry into that by giving, like, you know, a handful of measures that you can pick that shouldn't be all that difficult to meet, you know, given some lead time for it. And what they're trying to do, and the actual quote that I zeroed in on this from one of the Oscar people, and I can't believe I'm agreeing with like the Oscar person over Maximum Rock and Roll for this, is they said what they were trying to do is widen the aperture of what they're trying to represent. So they're creating these rules that are not entirely unreasonable and set somewhat in the future. But the idea is that by sticking this wedge into the existing system, they're going to start letting more people who are underrepresented into the system. And the wedge isn't so blunt and so like exclusionary that it's going to prevent anyone that's already in there from taking part. It just means that they have to start making some different choices about how they're staffing and what kind of stories they're telling and stuff like that into the future, right? Now, whether that's right or wrong, ultimately, and I know you're against...
It's wrong.
I know. Whether that's right or wrong, that is a way that you do, that you get to this type of end goal with, like, some amount of forethought and tact, right? Whereas, as the Maximum Rock and Roll's way of doing it was just sort of just like, fuck you, we're doing this! And, okay, like, that's... Like, they have to contend with the fact that the rock and roll scene, right, punk rock or otherwise, in the United States, in Canada, in the Western world, is predominantly white. So if you are a rock and roll publication, by excluding all of that from your publication, you are thusly excluding the audience that would have tuned in because they were interested in those bands or topics and stuff like that, which means whatever you are going to promote in their place, whether the quality of that stuff is good or bad, and I'd argue that the quality of it is probably great, whatever you're going to promote in its place is not going to have the attention that it did because you've just nuked a bunch of your audience. So it just, like, I'm looking at what the Oscars have done, and again, whether it's right or wrong, or the end goal is right or wrong, they're doing it in a way that looks like someone sat down and thought about, like, how do we get from A to B in a way that gives the people that are sitting at A right now some ability to help us get to B, what Maximum Rock and Roll is doing is say, okay, we have A, we want to be to B, so what we're going to do is just like exclude A and do it in a really loud, obnoxious way, and then hopefully B becomes what we're known for. But I don't know, like, if you are an artist that is of color, like, do you just hop on board now and give Maximum Rock and Roll the brand the credit here, or is there some degree of pandering in what they're doing there, and that they should maybe be a little bit more useful to you than just blowing up their audience? I don't know. That's my read on this, John. Is that so? Yeah, I don't disagree with you. It's just that I'm looking at it and saying that there are admirable goals that one could have in increasing representation, and I just don't know. I don't know if you had the power of the Maximum Rock and Roll brand at your fingertips, and you decide that, you know what, increasing representation is something that's important to you now. Why you would not try to go about that in a way that doesn't create like 15 extra hurdles for you?
I just don't know why you would intentionally be extremely racist, and not even just racist towards white people, but racist against people that are not white and more. Solve the problem. What are we going to do?
Well, step one. Well, yeah, like, this was something that it took a bit, and again, different like angles and stuff. I agree that they could have done this much better than what they did. And it just seems like a temporary PR job just to like, again, boost their image and be like, oh, look at us, you know, we're inclusive or whatever. Their heart isn't in it at all. And this is 100% a branding thing. If this was genuine, Adam, like you were saying, like, they would have done it and not really like called attention to themselves, because this is taking 100% of the attention and all of, you know, the effort and conversation back to Maximum Rock and Roll, not back to what, you know, Izzy, the issue with people of color being underrepresented and, you know, other marginalized groups being underrepresented. The other thing that kind of like threw me off with it was the whole paying certain contributors but not paying other contributors when you've never paid contributors before. Because on their Get Involved page, they say like, you know, we will always be a volunteer-run operation. All proceeds will either be used to cover expenses or be donated to similarly minded not-for-profit projects. So it seems like that goes against their own ethics. But then in their statement there that they released, how it said that, was it, expecting black people to work for free is white supremacy or something along those lines. So I don't know. It just, they could have done it a lot better. They could have actually done something to further, like, the writing of people of color, bands made up of people of color. You know, they could have done so much more instead of just kind of look at us. It just seems so inauthentic. In my
wham. Well, listen, I agree with you. I just think you're trying to be cute, honestly, but. I mean, you can be cute and edgy and not be explicitly racist. And again, people are like, oh, white tears. But their rules aren't just racist towards white people. They're racist against Native Americans. They're racist against people of Asian background. You named it, you know? So it's like,
that sticks out as the most, as the weirdest part of this whole of the whole statement that they put out, right? Because when you see statements about, like, when you see organizations get together with the goal of promoting underrepresented groups within rock music. They don't phrase it as, we're not going to talk about white music, we're going to talk about black music, for all the reasons that you just expressed, right? Like, it's always phrased by, and you know, by you know, it's always phrased by one of the acronyms or something, like it's BIPOC or something like that, right? Like, it's because they're trying to get around exactly what you're zoning in on here, which is that, you know what, there are people of color that are not black, there are indigenous people, right? Like that could possibly be included in this group of people that are underrepresented. And you'll see that when these organizations that are actually like sincerely focused on solving this goal are making those kinds of statements, right? The Lingua Franca Festival that I just talked about, like they always use BIPOC, right? For when they're talking about it like that. And it's because the people that organize Lingua Franca are people of color, and they've decided that like that is the appropriate way to approach that thing. Like the Maxim Rock and Roll statement, and again, I hate to cast a dispersion without actually knowing who came up with it, sounds like it was written by a white person. And it sounds like it was written by a white person being reactionary on the internet. And that is not, even if that's not the case, that's not the vibe that you want to project.
Well, listen, let's talk about a vibe you should project. Ska Against Racism. Now, so anyway, there's a new record coming out. It's three LPs. It's called Ska Against Racism. It's being put out sort of in conjunction by Asian Man Records, Bad Time Records, and Ska Punk Daily. And it's got a ton of bands of all racial backgrounds, and they raised about $60,000 to benefit to Black Lives Matter organizations and organizations of a similar ilk. It's got on it a bunch of really awesome bands. It's got finally the first physical release of that Tim Armstrong, Jesse Michaels track, but it also has Catbite on it. It's got Omnicon on it. It's got Mike Parks band on it. It's got Ska2 Network on it. It's got Kill Lincoln on it. It's got a ton of I should actually pull up the article. It's got a ton of really cool bands, and the track list looks pretty sweet. One thing I did want it's got Hepcat on it. It's got The Interrupters. Some of the tracks are exclusive. Some of the tracks are just reissues and songs that have already been released before. One thing is, you could say it. Well, you know, in the 90s, there were all these Ska Against Racism compilations or whatever. And did that really solve anything? Because racial tension is worse now than it's been in 30 or 40 years, which is true. But on the other hand, with this compilation just raised 60 grand for organizations, which is a lot more than Maximum Rock and Roll did. But I would say even more importantly, there are bands of all racial backgrounds on here. And I saw people of all races saying, yeah, this is awesome, and people all being psyched together about this collection of art, like being psyched and being happy and working together and being excited to be part of a community. So I would say this is doing everything right, and Maximum Rock and Roll is doing everything wrong. And not only that is Tim Timebaum and Jesse Michaels have the first track. They're kind of the biggest name here. They're two white guys, you know. But, hey, maybe it's not so bad to have white guys saying to other white guys, listen, racism is not cool, but also – it's cool that, all right, that's the entry point. But then once you get pulled in by that gate, there's a whole bunch of bands on here that are of different backgrounds, such as Bite Me Bambi, such as Ska2 Network, Catbite, let's see here, Hepcat, Planet Smashers, Chinkies, bands of all different backgrounds, and they're all coming together for a common purpose to be nice to each other instead of urging segregation. And I think that's the way to do it.
I mean, it bears mentioning that this compilation is named after the Ska Against Racism tour, which happened in 98, that was organized by Mike Park, that is a Korean American who, I guess, like, given the current rubric of Maximum Rock and Roll, is outside of the
yeah, he didn't get paid for his contribution.
Yeah, he wouldn't get paid for contribution to Maximum Rock and Roll because he's Korean. So yeah, I mean that's interesting. I mean I think this is going to sound goofy, but the political machinations of the ska and punk scene in my youth were incredibly important to making me into the person that I was today, even when they were dumb. And it matters, I think, to a young person getting into this kind of music to kind of hear these messages in ways that are like inclusive and welcoming and stuff like that. So I went around for like my whole high school years with like a no swastika pin on my shirt. And that was entirely a Ska Against Racism thing. Got like all those images of like the specials guy putting the swastika into the trash can, like all that stuff. Like as silly as that stuff is, and as like unsubtle as it is, like that had an impact on my understanding of the world. And I tuned into a lot of like, you know, anti-racist action things through stuff that Mike Park was doing, through, you know, Plea for Peace and what Hopeless and Sub-City were doing. And, you know, that kind of stuff is important to kind of throw into the face of your privileged, you know, white kid that's listening to this music, because it's the rest of society is not necessarily giving you the avenue into being part of those conversations. So, you know, it's important. And the, you know, while something like Ska Against Racism may seem gentle, may seem like it doesn't have the teeth of something like the Maximum Rock and Roll Statement or anything like that, like it's a wedge. Like it helps. It gets you interested in that kind of stuff. It gets people into that world. I mean, I've said before on this show, like a huge part of my like political upbringing was listening to the fucking Dropkick Murphys sing about union stuff. Like I would not have had like as much exposure to like the workers' rights world or like that area of politics if I would not have entered into it through like a fucking dumb shit, you know, faux Irish street punk band, you know, talking about those things. So that kind of stuff is important. So from that standpoint, you know, I'm all about things like this. I mean, nostalgically, it's wonderful to see Ska Against Racism all of a sudden rear its head, especially in this year where we've been contending with so many of these issues in public. But you know, these things are useful. You know, you may have gotten into this kind of music because, you know, you like upstroke guitars and horns, but there's, you know, something like this helps kind of get you further in. So yeah, there we go. I feel like Ska Against Racism is very like 90s sort of nostalgia trip though. Like did outside of this compilation, sorry, being a thing that is like a good thing. Like, M, like, did you have like, cause you're a younger person here. Like did Ska Against Racism have any particular relevance to you?
Definitely listened to ska music and got the anti-racist messaging, from it, but I hadn't.
But like as a brand, like Ska Against Racism would not be a thing that you would have like if you were doing a crossword like if you were doing a crossword puzzle last week and it said Ska Against, you would not have necessarily thrown racism into the box.
Probably not.
Right? But for me, yeah. Like this compilation came up and I was just sort of like, oh yeah, Ska Against Racism. It'd be good for that to come back, right? So it's so yeah, there's a nostalgia trip here for sure, but you know, inarguably a good one, I guess. John, are we off the contentious part of the show then?
I think we are. I think we've got one sad, one wacky as hell, and one interesting article coming up. Let's play a song. Let's clear the air. We'll come back. And hopefully we're not all canceled by that. Who's going to play a song?
All right, M, you jump in here.
All right. So I have a song, and it's called Play Fair. So it's by a London-based punk duo, and they're called Nova Twins. And the song is off Who Are the Girls, which was released in February of this year. So check it out. It's garagey, it's noisy, it's fun.
Brings the semi-obscure bands that I haven't heard of, and they are almost always totally rad.
Woo! Thanks.
So anyways, let's talk about an M More band that may have been totally rad, but they're not totally rad anymore because they broke up. M More, Milk Teeth, a band that you quite enjoy, broke up. And they had one of these kind of, melancholy statements. After battling with the decision for over a year, the time has come for me to move on to a new part of my life. Today marks the bittersweet end of Milk Teeth. A huge thank you to anyone who has supported us and myself over the 8 years. And thank you for all the incredible memories, conversations, and back through the good and the bad. I won't ever forget where it all started. Four kids from Stroud making the music they loved in college. We did more than we ever imagined possible, and I will be forever proud of how much was achieved. Sending love to you all, and see you all in the next chapter. And more, how are you feeling now that a band that you enjoyed is not breaking up?
Weird. Because the last time I was on the podcast, I was talking about they released a fan shot video for Sharks. And in what I said, I was like, oh, you know, like, I really want to see them live, and, you know, they'd be so cool, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then the next thing I know, it's like, hey, guess what? We're not around anymore. Thanks. So that was just really funny. Just the timing of it.
What's your opinion of, like, see, like, there's a couple of ways. Back in the day when bands would break up, they'd be like, you know, I hate Liam. You know, he's a dick. The band's over, you know. And now usually when bands break up, they're either like, we're going on a hiatus. Or they're like, I've struggled with the decision. I've spent nights rocking myself to sleep, wondering what should I do. And I'm afraid it's time for this arc to bend towards the south and carry on through the western wind. And you're like, what are you talking about? What's your opinion of a band where they, I guess, do a sort of romantic explanation, and romantic in the traditional sense, that is not romantic in the horny sense. What's your perspective when they do a romantic statement of the band breakup? Do you feel that's fitting, mature, and tasteful, or is it overblown and exhausting?
I think it depends on the band. I think if it fits, like, how they were, like, if they were a band that, like, always seemed to get along, you know, then, like, that would be fitting. But if they were a band that was, like, always, like, at each other's throats, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I love you, you know, I'm going to miss you so much, then that's a little different. I think it's fitting for, like, Milk Teeth in particular, because at the end they were three people. And, like, they, from what I've seen and everything, you know, they all seem to get along very well. Emma Foster, so started playing with them. She's in another band called Nervous. And I actually started listening to them before Milk Teeth. And then I found out, oh, you know, this band's kind of connected. So I started listening to them. But, you know, everything seemed very, like, amicable, and, like, it ended on their term, which I think is really important for bands, you know, as well, because so many breakups seem kind of inevitable from other factors and from just people being horrible people, you know. So it's good to see, like, kind of something like this, like, oh, you know, we're gonna go our separate ways, thanks, and kind of that's it, folks.
Y'all seem to be forgetting the most important breakup of the modern age, which was of the otherwise unknown Toronto metal band Witch Rot back in 2018, with the statement, due to the unfortunate reality of the guitarist fucking my girlfriend of almost 7 years, Witch Rot will be taking an extended hiatus.
I forgot all about that.
Oh, God. That was in the news the other day, because the guy from that band was back with something. I don't know. Exclaim was writing about it. It was one of these things where, like, I don't care about whatever musical things are happening with any of these people at this point, because you have now cemented yourselves as being the breakup band. Like, you don't exist outside of that statement.
Adam, would you prefer bands do this gentle sort of melancholy breakup where they remain friends? Or do you want to see the band get in a literal fist fight on stage and that's the end?
I don't know. I feel like so many of the bands that, like, it's so easy these days to just, like, not do something for 3.5 years and just not be an active band, but still be a band. And I guess it's just because, like, you're an adult at that point, and you know, you're going to go have your kids, and you can't drive around in a van and all this kind of stuff. And those are boring. Like, I would, on the one hand, I would prefer, I want a date. I want the band to go, you know what? We're all going to go have kids. We'll come back in 2024 and do something cool. And that's the plan. And we'll see you then. I'd like that kind of statement. I haven't seen that kind of statement yet. It's always just like, we're not going to say anything and just leave you hanging for years until we mysteriously reemerge. You never hear anyone just being honest about it, where they're like, you know what, we need some time.
Well, speaking of a guy that's maybe not being honest about himself, or maybe he's actually, maybe he's being the only artist that is truly being honest about himself, Big Moose Van Holinken has released yet another album. This is, I think, his third album of the year and ninth album. Well, so Big Moose Van Holinken is the persona of some guy called Ryan Manhole. And the difference between Ryan Manhole and Big Moose Van Holinken is Ryan Manhole writes creepy songs about anime, whereas Big Moose Van Holinken writes creepy songs about how he wants to have sex with the My Little Ponies. His last album was his most extreme album. It was Big Moose Van Holinken as Steel Stud, which was Big Moose Van Holinken in the future warring with people that wanted to have sex with different horses than he wanted to have sex with. The new Big Moose Van Holinken album is called Pink Stallion, and it's very much a back to the basics album where every song starts off with a sample of Dee Dee doing 1-2, not Dee Dee, no. Yeah, Dee, shit, who yells 1-2-3? Is it Marky or Dee Dee that yells 1-2-3-4? It's Dee Dee, right? Or is it Marky or Tommy?
I feel like it would be Tommy, but I don't actually know now that you've asked me this. I feel like
I think I might actually be Dee Dee.
I feel like I'm negative.
Anyway, shit. We should know this, Adam.
We should know this. This is a we've exposed ourselves.
No, 1-2-3-4. That's Dee Dee. I'm almost sure it's Dee Dee. So anyway, every song starts with Dee Dee yelling 1-2-3-4, and then they play a Ramones chord track about wanting to have sex with cartoon horses. And he's literally
It's Dee Dee for the record.
Whew. All right. He's literally written dozens, if not hundreds of songs about wanting to have sex with the My Little Ponies. And at first I was totally creeped out, and I'm still creeped out, but I'm fascinated that this guy has written literally hundreds of songs about having sex with anime and My Little Ponies. And at this point, I'm fascinated and listening to it. Is this unhealthy? Is the joke over? Or is the joke so extreme that it's still funny? And also, I thought this guy – well, how old do you think this guy is? Because I totally call it wrong. Adam, you might remember how old he actually is.
I don't know. 26?
And how old do you think Big Moose Van Holinken is, the guy that writes dozens to hundreds of songs about wanting to have sex with the My Little Ponies?
I'm going to go older than I think. I'm going to go 37.
He's like 45.
Oh, my
God. And it's not wholesome. I'll tell you that. But it's fascinating. Adam, are we dancing with the devil by posting this stuff? Like, are we going to find out bad stuff about this guy that's really going to put egg on our face? Or and more? Should we just keep covering the Big Moose Van Holinken as the next fearless expansion into the new art space?
I mean, are you dancing with the devil by posting this stuff? Yes, but the here's. We were in an era for a while where the concept of the adult brony was a minor point of cultural fascination, in the same way that like furries were a point of cultural fascination for a while. But that harkens back to a more innocent age where there were not fucking Nazis in the streets and stuff like that. So I don't know how the brony narrative carries over into 2020. I don't think it does. So, if anything, Big Moose Van Holsten doing his thing and sticking to this track in this era, I don't think reads as it doesn't read as like delightfully outsider art as it may have two or three years ago.
But doesn't that make it truly outsider art in that it's so out of time and so bizarre? You know,
on the one hand, I guess, because, you know, he could be singing about having sex with like Paw Patrol or something if he really wanted to be, you know, focusing in on what the kids are watching. But like, I don't know. Like, on the one hand, yeah, I guess it's more outsider art because it's truly offbeat from what the rest of the world is doing. But on the other hand, it's, I don't know, can you be outsider art and equally, you know, relevant to current trends? Like, there's outsider art, and there's outsider art where you're winking at the internet. And you being a brony-based musician 4 or 5 years ago was definitely appeared to be winking at the internet. If you were going to continue to do that for the rest of your career, 2020 and beyond, then you're not winking at the internet. Like you're really committed to this. And I don't know if you're committed to it in a way that I'm interested in following you on that journey with.
And more, what's your stance on Big Moose Man Hollington? Great fun or possibly a genuine pervert?
I'm going to go with a bit of both there. I don't think there's one solid answer. But like, again, teach their own, you know, as long as you're doing no harm.
Do you remember when bronies were an issue? And like brony, there was a while ago where we were talking about bronies and we were talking about fucking juggalos and just, you know, you had this whole, like the universe was just full of like delightful, strange things. And now it's, you know, now everything's on fire. I don't know. I prefer the old way.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead, Em.
Doesn't everything on fire make this seem like almost like normal? Like more wholesome?
Yeah, it seems actually, it's a throwback, right? It's like, man, remember when we could just focus on like the brony issue and that was the issue?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Is people should get upset about bronies and stuff, and it's like, there's so much more worse stuff to worry about that bronies like don't even register. You know what I mean? It's like, but then again, if he is a pervert, and I'm not saying that he is, I don't know. I mean, at first I thought it was a guy portraying a character, but he's put out so many albums as he's Big Moose Man Hollington, and it's like after a while, like it's not funny. You know what I mean? So why are you still doing it? You know, I'm fascinated. I'm considering doing an interview with this guy, but it could go bad or it could be really interesting. You know what I mean? But if I interview him as a normal guy, then it would suck. But then if I interview him as a true pervert, then it really sucks. There's got to be like that sweet spot where like he's like weird, but not totally unwholesome. You know, I don't know, man.
There's got to be some judgment call you make where before you do an interview where you say, like, does this person potentially have like a basement full of skulls? And if they do,
if skulls is the worst thing he's got down there, then I'm relieved. You know what I mean? All right, listen. We got one more story. Oh, listen. All right, let's talk about a more. Somehow, this band is astoundingly more wholesome than Big Moose Man Hollington. F'd Up. They released a new live album this past weekend during a Record Store Day, Freebie Day, or whatever, where the bands get 100% of the income. Side note: Bandcamp. I said Record Store Day. I meant Bandcamp. Bandcamp is killing it, people. Bandcamp rules. Anyways, F'd Up released a CBGB set from way back in 2000. I think it was 2007 when they were still a straight up hardcore punk band, and it was during their tour with Tragedy. 2006. During their tour with Tragedy and Mind Eraser and Kill Your Idols, which is one hell of a tour, man. It is interesting to look back at F'd Up as strictly a hardcore band because they haven't been that in a long, long time. And I think it's very cool that what is evident about F'd Up is they are punk and music fans to their core, like all of them. So with their own material, they are re-releasing it with a fan's eye view. Like other artists, and I don't mean this as an insult, other artists like aren't really fans of music, they're artists, you know? And so they might have this killer material that they'll never put out just because they don't care or they haven't cataloged it or kept track of it. Whereas the F'd Up, who are very much, you know, record collectors and music fans, have archived a big amount of their material. And now us, because they're fans, they can understand what we, the fans, would like to check out. And they released this, and I think this is rad. One other thing I do want to add is I keep going back and forth on Ceremony, who are not a hardcore punk band anymore, and I don't fault them for not being a hardcore punk band, but they have somewhat annoyed me with their purposeful distancing of themselves from punk and hardcore punk. Like I said, it seems to me, and I could be wrong, they almost take a certain joy from it, but then again, that could be because Ceremony fans really dogged them the further away they got from Power of Violence. I will say, F'd Up, from my perspective, has done a much better job of kind of drifting away from hardcore punk, but still being a punk band, but not necessarily pissing on their earlier work and rather, you know, cherishing their earlier work while doing something completely different now.
It's amazing to me how Damien is the same person between that era and now, because on these recordings, while on stage, he gets nerdy about the CBGB's history in the same way that you would hear him do it now on like his Turned Out a Punk podcast or something like that. But this is him on stage, like in the moment while performing and just being such like a lovable nerd about some of this punk history stuff. And it's just great to, it's great to hear that's just like a constant in that guy's life. And maybe that speaks to how Ceremony, you know, take themselves maybe more seriously than Fucked Up does in a way. This isn't really,
maybe that's it. Like, honestly, Effed Up has a much better sense of humor than Ceremony. Maybe that's it. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
They don't have a sense of humor in a way that like diminishes their ambitions for the next thing that they're going to put out or anything like that. But despite how ambitious the next thing that they put out is, they're certainly not going to come out and like try to ignore the roots where they came from or any of the stuff that they kind of like used to get to that point, which is, I think, one of the nice things about it. So this is a super interesting slice of history though, right? Because so 2006, so Fucked Up is at that point, you know, canonically a hardcore band. The Epics and Minutes compilation had maybe been put out by Deranged that collected a lot of their early 7-inch stuff, but Hidden World, their first proper LP, had not yet been released. Like, this was recorded in May, so Hidden World would have come out in October of that year. So, you know, before any of Fucked Up's like true ambition had started to be digested by the wider music world or anything like that. Now, you can still hear during these songs, like, the crowd of that show are screaming along to these tracks, like Baiting the Public and stuff like that. Like those big early Fucked Up songs were, you know, people were totally into. So like you can hear their audience, you know, fully engaged, even in New York, in what they were doing prior to them having like, you know, got the indie world interested in what they were doing. So you've got that aspect to it. You got the aspect that this was a matinee show at CB's, and CB's had like was sort of like famous for doing hardcore matinees on Sundays. This was like a rare Monday matinee show, and this was in the waning period of CBGB's, because CB's closed in October of 2006, right? So the CB's closed like a week or so after Hidden World came out. So this was a show during CB's final year, during their final run before they became whatever the fuck that building is now, right? So just being able to go and kind of like,
it's a John Varvatos,
it's a whatever that is, right? Yeah. I love that they put that on the cover though of the record, right? But the like it's on the one hand, like it captures that like nascent Fucked Up era. It captures like the waning years of, or like the waning year of CBGB's. The fact that it manages to kind of like do those two things makes this like a very cool kind of artifact to kind of go put out into the world. So, but yeah, I don't know. This is neat. It's neat for a few reasons. It's neat.
That's Em, are you down with Effed Up or you don't care?
Oh, no, they're one of my favorite bands and I loved this. I've listened to it an unhealthy amount of times, and it's one of the things that has brought me the most joy in this whole shit show of a year.
And do you think Effed Up's been putting out a lot of cool archival releases? They put out Mixtape,
yeah,
6, Rivoli, Mixtape 6, actually one of the best mixtapes they've done, I think. Rivoli and Live at CBGB's. You think we'll get physical versions of these? Because I would love to get physical, even a cassette tape form.
I think so. I have that feeling. But I think it's going to be something like, I don't think it's going to be for a while.
Effed Up in their limited stuff.
John, you, I gotta step in here. You're not from Toronto. It's Rivoli. It's the Rivoli.
I don't even know, the Ravioli?
No, the Rivoli. It's a venue. It's the name of a venue in Toronto. It's the Rivoli.
I didn't even know that.
I was thinking about that earlier today, where there's a handful of bands that have gone really all in with putting out like either isolation era recordings or really cool archival releases, like during this whole stupid year where they can't tour. And I wonder what happens to some of that stuff after, when we're through this. If you're one of those, if you're one of these bands that's gone and released like four or five cool records strictly online, strictly through Bandcamp, just to give you some amount of income, right, throughout this area, what do you do with that? I want the box set. I want the 2020 was fucking horrible, but here's all the weird stuff on vinyl box set to show up in 2021. You know, I want them to stick the vaccine in my arm and then they hand me the box set of here's your commemorative, I survived 2020 t-shirt, but in record form. And it shows all this crazy shit. That's what I want.
The issue though, that vinyl is so expensive. I mean, I'd be thrilled with a CD. I'll take a cassette, you know.
Something to commemorate us somehow getting through this year. All right, here's a piece of music that you can chew on before we wrap things up here. So there is a really cool band that was called Kappa Chow. They were out of Sackville, New Brunswick. They were doing this revisionary take on proto-punk. And then Kappa Chow broke up and they moved to Toronto. And then they became a band called Protruders with a lot of the same people. And Protruders continued this really cool, proto-punk thing. And then they all moved out of town and then there was a pandemic. So then they broke up. So now Joe Chimandi, who is the guy that's been behind both these bands, has a third act that he has gone and put together. It is called Itchy Self. Itchy Self is releasing a EP called Here's the Rub on October 2nd. Joe has moved himself to Montreal during this era. And the Itchy Self music, it calls to mind influences of, say, the Saints and the Rats and Neon Boys. It calls to mind the Orc Records catalog. So here you go. This is the first single from the first release from Itchy Self. It is awash in cool proto-punk vibes. It is called God Bless the Ego. Here you go.
Soul of Reclamation.
and that was the Itchy Selves doing God Bless the Ego. And more, we made it through another week. We talked about some fans. We talked about some divisive stuff that might get us canceled next week. How do you feel standing on the precipice of cancellation?
I'm looking into the abyss. The abyss is looking back.
Adam, when you look into the abyss, does the abyss look back at you with, you know, disdain, with joy, with a come hither look? What's the look that the abyss stares at you with?
So, John, I made this pasta sauce to go with dinner tonight, and I threw a hot pepper in there because I was trying to be cute, and I had a hot pepper in the garden. And it was way too hot because it was one of these like Russian roulette hot peppers that it turns out it was like incredibly more hot than I thought. So I'm the only one eating this at dinner because it was of an insane, Scoville range. I'm the only one eating it. And my wife kind of jokes to me that Simpsons line where Lisa eats something hot and she can see through time. And
you mean Homer eats a hot chili pepper? Time and hangs out with Johnny Cash?
Johnny Cash was the coyote, but I'm pretty sure I remember Lisa saying, like, I can see through time or something like that, right? So I stew on this for a brief moment, and I'm thinking that, like, you know, I see through time after eating the spice is a Dune reference, and I start getting into the Dune reference at the table. And my daughter is like, I wouldn't want to see through time because then I'd know what I got for my birthday.